Hello there, and you're very welcome to Terrace Talk. Wishy Fogarty with you for the next hour, and as usual, we're going to have what promises to be a fascinating programme. The name of Dr. Eamon O'Sullivan will always be a household word as long as Gaelic games and athletics live on in Ireland. Eamon's record-breaking feat as trainer of 8 All-Ireland winning Kerry teams, his staging of the college competition, and his organisation of athletic meetings throughout Ireland in the late 20s will be talked about for many a long day. Others will remember him as a man who brought a breath of fresh air and hope to the mentally ill through the pioneering of open-air therapy as a worthwhile method of treatment. Dr. Eamon will be remembered and cherished most of all as the creator, innovator, administrator, trainer, author and player. He was the man who dreamed great dreams and brought them to fruition. The creator of the great Fitzgerald Stadium, erected by him and his contemporaries, is a fitting memorial to one of the greatest footballers of all, Dick Fitzgerald. The magnificent stadium stands as a lasting tribute to the foresight, energy and ability of Dr. Eamon. And I am delighted and honoured to have as my guest the eldest of Dr. Eamon's four sons, James, who will talk to us about the man he knew as his father and remind us of just some of the great projects his late father initiated. James, you're very welcome to Terrace Talk. A brief visit to Killarney, but from where do you come?
I live in Croydon in England, but I do return to Killarney virtually every year, and it's always glad to come back and see the beauty of the town and the surrounding district and to visit some old friends that are still around.
James, you're the eldest of the boys. Talk to us about your early memories. Tell us, first of all, where you were born.
I was born when my father, Eamon, was still the assistant medical officer in the mental hospital. So I was born in his quarters to the right of the main entrance of the hospital, a small self-contained house attached virtually to Pugin's design as an afterthought. And there, in the top upper bedroom, I was born in the year 1931, the eldest of Eamon's four children.
And your earliest memories of St. Finan's and growing up around there, James?
It was a wonderful experience, really, because St. Finan's, though it was part of the town of Killarney, had a very separate existence of its own. It was slightly remote. It was subject to certain strict orders about arriving back at certain times in the evening when the gates were closed. So an element of isolation occurred. And I can remember being impressed by the way in which the staff as a community survived in this environment. They even intermarried. Fathers and sons and daughters followed fathers and mothers into the hospital as a career path. And all of this led to a very close community sense that we were all part of, children growing up and the staff and the medical staff themselves. And of course, in the background, ever present and in our consciousness were the patients themselves, sometimes figures, forlorn, sad, but nonetheless very human beings, treated with great dignity and respect by all of us. And it was a pleasure to grow up in that environment.
And of course, James, there was over 1,000 patients there at that time. Now, when we're doing this interview, there's only something like 90 there, and St. Finan's is going to be sold. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, history moves on, of course, and Kerry today is a very different place from it was, say, in the 30s, the pre-war years, and even through the war years, when everything was so quiet and isolated. We have to move on. The science of psychiatry itself has progressed wonderfully to the benefit of the patients. There isn't the same need to virtually incarcerate people in large numbers in vast Victorian institutions. We know that now, and we have responded to that. And my own father, Eamon, was always keen to try and alleviate the burden the patients were faced with in their isolation by, in his particular case, concentrating on occupational therapy as a means to soften their burden. And in that, he was very successful.
Now, your memories of your dad when you were a young fella, tell us, what kind of a man was Eamon? What kind of a father was he to four young boys?
Well, he was a large man, so therefore, to a young child, he was a very dignified and imposing figure that had to be treated with respect. He wasn't a strict disciplinarian, but nonetheless, he wanted us to obey certain rules, and we were brought up in a rather strict way, I would imagine, certainly by today's standards. But he was a tolerant man, and my feelings for him, even as a young teenager and later as a young man, was one of love rather than respect. I had a great admiration for him, but I had a love for him. He was a wonderful man with a warm spirit, and it came across to you when you were in his presence. It was never boring. A journey in the car with him to the country, maybe to attend a sports meeting, was an adventure, because he knew exactly the stories of the places we travelled through, the towns that produced great footballers or hurlers in their time. And all of this was presented to me as a young child growing up. And he was always close to his county, to his country, to his sport. And that rubbed off on us very much.
Now, staying with your dad, of course, and talking about his history, tell us who he married and tell us about your grandfather and tell us about the connection with the previous RMS at St Finan's, who was another Dr Griffin. Talk to us about that side of your dad's life.
Now that we look upon the closure, the eminent closure of St Finan's, my mind goes back to the plaque over the hall door which said the hospital was opened in 1849. And, of course, I looked at that plaque, say, in 1949, so I saw the 100 years spread out behind me, as it were. Now, my father came to Killarney as a locum doctor, and while he was there, a vacancy occurred for an assistant at St. Finan's, and he had to undergo a canvassing process to get to win that appointment, and it was very complex and detailed, but he turned out to be successful. So he took up the post under Dr. Griffin, Dr. Edward Griffin, who came from Ballyhaig, as assistant medical officer. Now, Dr. Griffin had a bevy of daughters, and the second or third daughter caught Eamon's eye, and within a year or two they were involved in a secret courtship. My mother, Marjorie, was at school in Drishan at that time, and Eamon was visiting her, and the nuns thought he was her medical advisor. They didn't realize it was a more personal relationship. So that's how we came into being, as it were. But on this visit to Kerry this summer, I found out a rather remarkable coincidence of an earlier event that took place. There was an earlier Dr. Griffin who was not a member of our family, had no blood relationship. He had come to Killarney at the request of the Earl of Kenmare, who had an epileptic son who lived in the priory in Killarney near the river. And this Dr. Griffin acted as a medical supervisor for this young boy who wasn't very well and wasn't very healthy. And then eventually the child died, and Lord Kenmare was able to use his obvious influence to obtain for that Dr. Griffin the appointment as medical superintendent of the hospital, which in those days wasn't known as St. Finan's. It was known as the Killarney District Lunatic Asylum, KDLA. Those are letters that are emblazoned in my mind, because in my early childhood, I remember the brooms that were used in the hospital had the letters burned into their shafts so that nobody could abscond with the hospital equipment. But we remember it, of course, as St. Finan's more and more recently. Now, Dr. Griffin took up that appointment, and he was a married man who had been, in fact, married two times. His second wife had a ward who was an English lady called Marjorie Stokes. And sometime later, my grandfather, Dr. Griffin from Ballyhaig, returned from work in the medical service in England back to his home county, Kerry, and obtained the appointment as medical assistant at the mental hospital. And he, at that point, went on to marry Marjorie Stokes, my maternal grandmother, who was the ward of Dr. Griffin, his superior at that time. So twice in the history of our family, the Griffin family in particular, was there a sort of connection with the hospital and an intermarriage between the assistant doctor and the daughter of the superintendent. And I think that's quite a remarkable thing.
A remarkable story. We're going for a short break. Stay with us on Terrace Talk. And you're very welcome back to Terrace Talk. I'm talking to James O'Sullivan, one of the sons of the great legendary Dr. Eamon O'Sullivan, who trained Kerry to win 8 All-Ireland titles. We're talking to James about his life and times. James, just before we go for before we went for a break there, we were talking about Dr. Griffin. Of course, Marjorie's father was a great man for the Greyhounds, wasn't
That's
he?
Right, yes, yes.
Let's not forget that. And talk about your mother to us.
Yes. Dr. Griffin came from farming stock in the village of Ballyhaig. And quite remarkably, I would have said, for the times, graduated through National University or whatever it was, the equivalent was then, and became a doctor and went over to England to work for a number of years, eventually specializing in mental health. He worked, we know, in the mental hospital in Wakefield, for example, and I have photographs of him from that era where he's standing in a cricket team, in actual fact. So by instinct, he was, in his own right, a great sportsman. When he came back to Kerry, and as I explained, married into the Griffin family and took up his appointment as the RMS at St. Finan's, he continued his interest in sport. He trained greyhounds as a hobby during his time as a RMS. And in fact, by the end of 1919, he had one remarkable winning dog called Guards Brigade, which he took over to England for the Waterloo Purse in 1919, and again in 1921 for the Waterloo Cup, and the dog was successful on both occasions. Tragically, there was a foot-and-mouth outbreak in England, I believe, which prevented the dog being brought back to Ireland, and Dr. Griffin had to sell the dog to some English lord.
What was your mother's background then? Where did she come from, James?
My mother, of course, was, I presume, born and reared in St. Finan's, like so many of her family. Her father was the doctor there, and she grew up in that environment. She was a member of a large family. There were three boys and probably five girls. And like we did in our time later, they ran wild round the hospital as they were growing up as children.
Now, turning back to your dad, I do know from following his career, he kept himself abreast with everything, national and international. And I never knew, James, that he was an official at the 1936 Berlin Olympic Games. Yes. Talk to us about what you know about what I've just said to you.
I don't know a great deal about it, other than the fact that he did attend with the Irish team as an official at those games. And, of course, he did talk about it, having come back. But what I remember in particular, he was very impressed by Germany as a country and by the organization of the games. He came back talking about the cleanliness of Germany, the punctuality of the trains, the organization of the games, the facilities made available for the athletes, and so on. He had, in fact, a very strong respect for the Germans as a result of that experience. It wasn't until later when World War II broke out that we began to learn of some of the sinister aspects of National Socialism. And then, of course, he had to review his outlook and attitude. It so happened that at the time, just before the war, we rewired the mental hospital and the contract went to a German company, as indeed Paul Nofuka in Limerick went to a German company when that hydroelectric facility was built. So there may have been some connection, but we had a German contractor group working in rewiring the mental hospital in those years, those months indeed, before the war broke out. And my father had a new car, and he had a collision with the foreman of the German construction company, and that also sort of reduced his admiration for the German nation.
Was he fairly conservative in his outlook, James?
I'd say yes. He was a very conservative man. He was a very knowledgeable man, as you know from his records, I've no doubt, through his love of Gaelic football, athletics, and his activities in medicine. He had a very broad outlook, and that lent to tolerance. He had an innate ability to understand people and their problems. And I think that was one of the aspects of his personality that made him, endeared him, if you like, to the men, the young men that he trained all those decades of Kerry football history.
Now, did he talk to you about what many people might know, that he was going for the priesthood when he was a young man? What do we know about that side of his life?
Yes, that left a lasting impression on him and coloured, I'm sure, his outlook to life. He studied for the priesthood in Maynooth for 2 years, I understand, and then went to Rome, to the Irish College in Rome. But his tenure there came to a sudden end. He suffered some form of mental or physical breakdown. He never really discussed the details of it, but it was sufficient to, in fact, interrupt his career. And he came home, recuperated, and it was then that he started a medical career, went to college in Dublin.
You were telling me that he had a firm grounding in the classics, and of course he loved the Irish language, didn't he?
He did indeed, yes. He was a native speaker, even though we didn't speak Irish as our natural tongue in the house, in the home. He had this instinct, if you like, and love for the Irish language, and promoted it in his conversation and in his outlook at all times. He was proud of Ireland, proud of the heritage of place names, mountain names, and so on, and constantly bringing us to our attention as children. So we had a love for Irish too, even though we weren't ourselves fluent.
So I would imagine, James, when you'd be in the car travelling around of a Sunday afternoon, when you did a Sunday afternoon off, he'd be pointing out townlands, that's where such a footballer came from, and that's where such a fella came from. Yeah. Would I be right in saying that?
You would indeed. And it didn't apply just to Kerry alone. His knowledge of famous people and famous sportsmen extended throughout, if not certainly Munster, if not into Leinster, because journeys up to All-Ireland matches would feature the same commentary as we were travelling, and it was always made the journeys easy to engage, to pass.
Now, he trained Kerry winning teams in 24, 26, 37, 46, 53, 55, and 59, 62. Absolutely unbelievable by the one man. But there's one particular All-Ireland that stands out in your memory, and that's he didn't train the team in Killarney, or he didn't train the team in Tralee, and you were present. Tell us about where this Kerry team was trained.
This, I believe, was 1936, so I was 5 years old, so I really am stretching my memory.
I think just 37, actually.
37, sorry. Yeah. So I'm 6 years old. We took our summer holiday in Ballyhide that year to be near the retired Dr. Griffin and his family, and we were staying in a lodge in the village, and Eamon was approached by the county board. I think there must have been a drawn semi-final, was it, or a drawn final?
So, yeah.
So he was approached to train the team, and Eamon said, well, look, unfortunately, I'm on holiday, and I can't really upset my family by abandoning the holiday. But what I will do is, if you bring the team to Ballyhige, I will train them.
So it was a case of, if Muhammad can't go to the team will come to Muhammad.
Precisely. And I have a vivid recollection of, from the age of six, of the team behind the Castle Hotel in the village of Ballyhige undergoing their training regimes under Eamon's supervision.
Were you aware, James, at that time that he had trained winning teams in 24 and 26? Were you aware of what your dad meant to Kerry football at that particular time of your life when you were a young boy? Or was it too early for you to have memories of his previous years?
No, I wasn't aware of the previous records that he had accumulated, and I probably wasn't fully aware of the significance of what I was seeing. But I knew it was important, and I had a feeling of respect and interest in what was going on.
Now, we're going for a short break, and we'll be back shortly on Terrace Talk. And you're very welcome back to Terrace Talk. I'm talking to James O'Sullivan, son of Dr. Eamon O'Sullivan. James, the Killarney Golf Club, he took a huge part in the actual building of the course and the construction of the course. What do you know about that?
Oh, yes, that is very true. And perhaps in today's world, it's not fully remembered, so it would be interesting to present my recollections of those events. I vividly remember one day going out to Manny's Point with Eamon to meet Lord Castle Ross, as we called him, Viscount Castle Ross, but we called him Lord Castle Ross, who came out with his chauffeur and a bevy of beautiful miniature collie dogs. And the purpose of the visit was to examine the gamekeeper's lodge in Manny's Point, which was to be a temporary headquarters or clubhouse for the new golf course that was being considered at that time. And I remember vividly fighting our way through vast rhododendron bushes to get to the cottage and to survey it from that point of view. Now, that event probably took place in about 1936, perhaps. So Eamon was present with Castle Ross on those early formative years when the club was being planned and Castle Ross was prepared to donate the land to the club and its members.
And from that on then, he took a huge part in the Killarney Golf Course, and he was one of the men, as we were saying, who was instrumental in the building of it. But also, he had a great interest in bridge. A lot of people might know this. And he took an active part in the Irish Bridge Society, and he developed it here in Killarney.
Yes, he became a renowned international tournament director in Killarney in those years, probably during and after the war. My recollection is quite vivid about all of this because I was now perhaps a young teenager. Auction Bridge was popular in Killarney, and there was a club in existence at that time, and I'm thinking about late 30s again.
And for the sake of our listeners, and I'm not an expert on bridge, bridge is played with a deck of cards. Is my right or wrong in saying that?
That is correct. Yes. But it's a very skillful game and requires a lot of strategy and interpretation and skill. But auction bridge was played in Killarney, but the contract bidding type of bridge was gaining momentum around the world. And Eamon took an interest in this, and he produced a foolscap type sheet of paper, both sides, in which he designed a two-club bidding system, which he introduced to the town. And it was quite popular. It helped people get started on the contract bridge and then led to the explosion that took place consequently. Unfortunately, two-club conventions at that time were frowned upon by the experts in the bridge world. They wanted more sophisticated bidding systems. And it was many years later that Eamon pointed out to me an article in the American Bridge Journal by Eli Culbertson that now he had changed his attitude and he was fully prepared to accept the two-club bidding system as a respectable way of playing contract bridge. My father was delighted with this admission on the part of the expert.
You give me the impression of your father as a very gentleman, as a man that never raised his voice, correct me now if I'm wrong, and it was difficult to see him getting angry or getting cross or using bad language or anything like that. What type of a man was he behind the facade? What type of man was he away from the Kerry team? And what type of a man was he at home, sitting down by the fireside?
He certainly never tolerated bad language. In fact, he had to end a partnership in golf because of that very problem with more than one player. I remember that very vividly. At home, he was a quiet man. I had my disagreements with him as a child growing up. Young children get headstrong ideas and revolt a little bit. He disapproved of many things I did, but he always did it in a gentle way, never raised his voice, always appealed to your better sense rather than your instincts. And I learned over the years to adjust to that and to accept that as the way of making decisions. He was a homely man. I think his family meant a lot to him. He spent a lot of time watching the news through the press, listening to the radio, but he had time for his children. Our meal times were enlivened with conversation about a variety of topics. So we grew up in a very stimulating family circle, which I'm sure has benefited all of us throughout our life.
And you have very vivid memories, James, of visiting the church in St. Finan's with your father. And on your holiday home there lately, you visited the church again.
That is correct, yes. We were fortunate, again, it was part of the isolation, if you like, of the mental hospital. We had a priest come up every Sunday to say Mass, and we had a small chapel capable of seating probably about 200 people, and that would be full of patients and staff members. There was even a little balcony with an organ in it, and staff would go up there too. We had Mass there every Sunday, virtually, and very often the priest would stay on to have breakfast with the family after the Mass. So that church was very personal to me. In fact, I served my first Mass there as a youngster. And when I visited St. Finan's 2 summers ago with Neely O'Sullivan, the deputy head nurse, I asked if I could see the chapel again because it's so strong in my memory. And I went in, and I was a bit taken by surprise because it didn't look quite as I remembered it, and I suddenly realized what the difference was. There was, above the altar, a colored glass window, whereas in my time it was plain white glass. And I'd found out from Neely that the old church at Fusser had been closed down and the stained glass had been taken to St. Finan's and installed in that chapel.
Well, on my own part, after 38 years working there, that's news to me, James. So you learn something every day. It's a bad yes to the fellow that you wouldn't learn something. Moving on slightly now, and of course, I must touch on it. Fitzgerald Stadium is synonymous with Killarney. Anywhere you go, anywhere in the 32 counties and beyond, if you mention Fitzgerald Stadium, is associated with Killarney, one of the great stadiums of Ireland. Mm-hmm. And your father was instrumental in building it. And you remember the sod being turned. And not long that, there was a nicer story when it opened. Talk to us about the stadium, your memories, and the people who were involved in it, yes, and the patients and the staff and all.
Before mentioning perhaps the stadium, I should say a word about occupational therapy, because that's important to understanding this whole event. Dr. Griffin, as my father's predecessor, had developed the notion or the concept of occupational therapy, by which is meant in that context giving tasks to patients to fill their day and to keep them mentally active and alert to overcome the terrible burden of institutionalization and isolation. And Dr. Griffin in his day started this program going, which Eamon, my father, was very happy to pick up and to specialize in. And it was part of the concept of occupational therapy that encouraged him, looking out from the second floor of St. Finan's Hospital down towards the town, overlooking a huge, vast expanse of green field, to think that here was the location for a stadium or a playing field, but could also provide an opportunity for occupational therapy for the patients in the hospital. Remember, these patients were invariably of rural background, farming stock, and work, physical labor with a spade and shovel to them was meat and grist of their lives, really. And being given an opportunity to do work of that nature benefited them psychologically.
And just interrupting you there, at that particular time even, staff in the hospital were permitted to take patients out on their days off, and that was another form of occupational therapy, working with the staff, wasn't it, James?
Yes, that was an earlier development, strangely enough, yeah. Yes, attributed to Dr. Griffin. And the patients, I know, loved that experience. They went out for the 2 days, mainly with the senior nursing staff who had, I think, Monday and Tuesday free. They'd go out and they'd live with the family. They would help on the farms, remembering most of the staff had farms and themselves came from farming backgrounds and lived some close to Killarney, but many much further afield. I remember seeing staff members cycling to work from as far away as Ardfert, for example. So the concept of occupational therapy through labour was well enshrined in St. Finan's in those days of Dr. Griffin and later Dr. Eamon. So it all gelled together with the concept of the Fitzgerald Stadium.
And now we're going for a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be talking about the building of the Fitzgerald Stadium. And I can tell you it's fascinating stuff, because the first game that was played there, in 1936, James threw the ball in. We'll be talking about that when we come back. Stay with us on Terrace Talk. And you're very welcome back to Terrace Talk. James, the building of the stadium. Why was it built?
Well, you've got me there. There was a need. There's no question about that. There was an opportunity. There was a need. There was a requirement to collect finance. All of this gelled together. There was a remarkable bringing together of many influences, I think, that led to this great event. You mentioned earlier that the staff and the patients were accustomed to working physically on the farm and the hospital itself, and therefore for Eamon to consider lending their help to the building of the stadium was a natural development, a progression, and that's how it went. One or two members of the staff, and one I remember in particular was Denzo Hurley, was a male charge nurse at that time. He was given the responsibility to take a squad of patients and start turning sod, as you say, and the green field below the hospital. At the same time, Bill Landers had returned to take up life in Killarney, having been in America for a number of years.
He was the great Kerry footballer.
That is correct. One of three remarkably fine footballing brothers, in fact. Bill was a tall, dignified man, a great presence and great charm about him. And his first job on returning to Killarney was to get an appointment in the mental hospital as the driver of the lorry. The hospital had its own lorry, which was used in the construction of the stadium. And I remember riding with him in that lorry when earth was being moved round from the high part of the field to the low part to build the extension on the east wing of the field. Sometime later then, of course, as the park took shape, I was present when late Henry Downing, his town solicitor, came up with a chain to measure out the pitch for the markings of the pitch. And Eamon was always adamant that they'd make the pitch the largest pitch in the country. It would be wider and longer than any other football stadium in Ireland, which I think was probably maybe still the case today.
And, of course, the Dr. Crow Club in Killarney, he was a member of the Dr. Crow Club at the time, and they were really instrumental behind it all with him.
Oh, exactly, yes. There were many, many people who share this vision, and I'm sure it started as nothing more than a vision. Of course, I wouldn't, at that age, I wouldn't remember all of those personalities that were involved, but I knew it was a major team effort to get that stadium up and running.
And staying, James, with the occupational therapy side of it, he then came along at a later stage in his life and he wrote a massive book on occupational therapy, which was printed in a few different languages.
That is correct, yes. Because of his classical background, I'm certain, he had a love of language, not just Irish, but English also. He was a very good speaker. He had a love of the things in life that interested him, and it was obvious that he would always want to put down in print his feelings and recollections, and that applied to his professional work as a psychiatrist and also to his training as a Gaelic footballer. So it was natural, I think, very natural for him to put into print a record of his achievements and opinions in many of those two major fields of his life.
And, of course, he wrote a second book then on Gaelic football, The Art and Science of Gaelic Football, which is a collector's item now, of course, and I presume you have it because I have one myself.
Yes, I have two copies remaining, yes. And after your earlier Terrace Talk CD-ROM, I went to the book and read it again. And what impressed me about it was the very careful study he made of the history of the game, which I think is impressive. And I remember then that, of course, in our home, we had a lot of textbooks on football history, American soccer and other games that had similarities. And that led on eventually, in Eamon's case, to a very curious interest in Australian rules football. And he mentioned that to me in my presence a number of times, and in particular explained to me about the special form of the goals in Australian rules, which were prevalent in Gaelic football until about 1902. And I was very pleased to receive that bit of historical information, which may have got lost by the wayside nowadays.
James, was he talking about a connection between the GAA and Australian rules football? I mean, we know now it is a popular thing now, and it's happening on a continuous basis. He was way ahead of his time there.
Oh, yes, he had a vision again of that. Mainly because he wanted to encourage the concept of Gaelic football not just being a national game, but becoming an international game. That was an aspiration he had, I'm certain. And he saw the Australian rules and its similarity and common origin with Gaelic football as a means to achieve this. It has now happened. All right, it's not a perfect merging of the games yet, but we're on the road to possibly achieving an international status for the game. And that would please him tremendously.
How proud of Kerryman was he?
Oh, I can't put a measure on it, really.
Try.
It's difficult. He certainly was, and as I've said earlier, everything he did was a tribute to his home county, to the people in it whom he served, both as a trainer and as a physician. He had a love for all of them, a tolerance for all of them, a great pride in nature, in the geography, in the climate. He actually ran a weather station at St. Finan's, where he recorded for the Meteorological Service rainfall throughout the years.
And of course, James, he was involved in organising college football. He was captain of the Dr. Croke's team. He was involved in athletics. Do you know, what do you know about that side of his life? Anything stands out?
Not so much for me as it might well be for some of my younger brothers. I did attend sports meetings around the county with them as a young, quite a young child in my 8 to 10 year old period, that sort of period. I attended, of course, football games, watched football games in the stadium throughout the late 30s and throughout the war years, the 40s, witnessed some of the wonderful Munster final battles that occurred during those years.
And, of course, there are two football pitches called after your father in Kerry, which is most unique and most unusual. You and your family and your children and his grandchildren must be very proud of this course.
Yes. In fact, I stayed... I stayed in a B&B last summer in Killarney on my way back to London. And the gentleman of the house asked me questions about Eamon and asked me in particular when he first trained the Kerry team. And unfortunately, at the time, I couldn't answer the question. I eventually did some research and got in touch with him and gave him the information he wanted. But he pointed out to me that it must be unique in the world that in one country there are two stadia named after a father and a son. And I had never thought of it like that. I'd taken photographs of both stadia for my children and grandchildren, but I never realized that it was the uniqueness of both of them being honored in this way. And of course, for us as a family, this is a wonderful tribute, and we respect and love that association.
And getting back to the Fitzgerald Stadium, and is called after Dick Fitzgerald. And your father gave you a special memory about Dick Fitzgerald and an incident that he saw him performing.
Yes. My father had a great love and respect for Dick Fitzgerald, which extended back to his student days at St. Brendan's. He related to me once a story where they had been playing or practicing football at the seminary, and Dick Fitzgerald came in off the street and stood watching them for a while. And then they took a break, and Dick walked up and said, "Let me have the ball for a moment, boys, and I'll show you something that might interest you." So he took the ball and took it to the corner flag and did a place kick and put it over the bar in his normal street shoes. And my father was so impressed by this dexterity that he showed that it remained with him all his life. And I'm sure then when it came to naming the stadium in honor of Dick Fitzgerald, that was particularly important to my father and a source of pleasure to him.
I suppose a direct connection, Dick Fitzgerald, Morris Fitzgerald. They're the only two men that can do it.
Morris Fitzgerald, the footballer.
Well, nice connection, kicking the ball over the bar from the corner flag.
Yes. I don't know if Morris Fitzgerald did it. I saw him take that wonderful sideline free kick that won a game, and it was shown on television here in Ireland a couple of days ago. I remember Morris Fitzgerald, of course, because he was in the mould of all the great Kerry centre-field footballers. And I'm thinking of the Carsevine man.
That's right, yeah.
Mick O'Connell.
Yeah, that's right.
Who was a great protégé of Eamon's, and there was a wonderful relationship between the two of them in Mick O'Connell's day. And, of course, to see him play football was, I suppose, in the spirit of Kerry football, which you may not quite see again to the same degree, perhaps, rather sadly.
And, of course, in the family, there's a great history of sport in the family. Your grandfather was a great sportsman, the late J.P. O'Sullivan, and there's another pitch called after him. Now, we're going for a short break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about J.P. O'Sullivan. Stay with us on Terrace Talk. And you're very welcome back to Terrace Talk. James, J.P. O'Sullivan then, your dad's father, your grandfather, he was nearly as legendary as your dad.
He was.
The champion, he was known as.
He was known as the champion. A very fine, dignified man. Tragically, he died at a very early age, when my father was 11 years old only. So my father really didn't know him personally that well, I suspect. And he didn't talk a great deal about him. But there were certain anecdotes that ran through the family that came and reoccurred and resubmitted at different times. And I'd like to just mention a couple of those. JP, of course, had a wonderful career both as an athlete and as a Gaelic football player in the early formative years of the game, in fact, and has this long association with the Lown Rangers Club in Killoglan. He came to an untimely death attending a course meeting in Middleton in Cork, County Cork, in, I'm not quite sure now of the year, 1909, I believe. And it so happened, and this is just a family recollection, that the physician that attended him on the field was Dr. Edward Griffin, later to become Eamon's father-in-law. And of course, these were two sportsmen of the era who knew each other and who both trained greyhounds and ran greyhounds at course meetings throughout Munster. So there was a sadness for Dr. Griffin attending his great sportsman friend, JP, the champion. Now, Eamon talks about JP and the elements that he recollects, that he remembers about him. First of all, they spent summer holidays in Glen Bay, or Ross Bay in actual fact, in a row of villas that still exist today, which of course have been modernised. He talked about those holidays with great love and affection. He also mentioned to me that he was taken by JP to Listowel to see the Laratigue Railway in its heyday. Though having looked at some of the information about that now, I'm not quite sure of the dates, whether he actually saw the train in service or just saw the railway line after it had closed down. And that leads on to another aspect of JP's life that we know of, and that was that during the construction of the Farnham Fore Castlevean Narrow Gauge Railway, he at one time served as a paymaster on that programme. And that's about the sum total of the family recollection of JP, and I say that with sadness, because he was a great figure, he lives in a different era, he tragically died very young, and we don't know that much about him.
Great footballer with Lown Rangers, and the Lown Rangers pitch is called after him. And there's no doubt everybody you talk to, they'll tell you that he was an absolutely superb footballer. Getting back to your dad again, you still talk to you in his later years then, because he trained the winning Kerry teams in 24, 26, 37, 46, 53, 55, 59 and 62. A record. He never trained a losing All-Ireland team. He lost once in 1965. I think they were beaten by Galway. In his latter years, James, you still look back when you'd sit down with him. Would he have a pint? Would he have a drink? Would you sit down with him and talk about, and would he reminisce about those teams?
I think what most people don't know about Eamon was that he was a very severe diabetic from the age of 32, from the time he married, in actual fact, onwards, which meant that he had to lead a very carefully disciplined life. And there were periods in latter years when this became a bit of a problem. Long-term diabetics can sometimes lose their control or stability and may need to change their insulin and things of that nature. And Eamon certainly went through those trauma. So as a consequence, he was a very abstemious man. He prepared his meals and measured the amount of consumption very, very carefully, as you would expect a doctor to do, treating himself for a serious condition. He never drank much at all. He allowed himself half a brandy at the end of a golf game. And that was about all. We would, if we were out as a family visiting having a meal in a hotel in Cork or in Dublin, we would have a bottle of wine with the meal. But we didn't have wine at home as a natural course of events. I don't think anybody did in those days. I think wine was a sort of luxury item. So other than his little snorter of brandy on a cold day at Mahoney's Point, I never did see him drink at all.
And would he reminisce, didn't you, about the great eras of Kerry football that he was associated from he was associated in the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, the 50s and the 60s. Amazing. Even Mick O'Dwyer hasn't achieved that. Yes. Used he talk to you about those memories?
Oh, yes, yes. He would talk in a very quiet manner about his achievements, about the team and what they had accomplished and in what had been achieved on the playing field. And he would talk about what was happening during the course of training programs, what he was doing, how he hoped to bring the team to its peak of perfection at the right time, and so on. Remember, this was not an era of professional football training. It was done on an ad hoc basis as required. Very often, airmen's training was associated with a drawn semi-final or even a drawn final. It wasn't a natural thing to train, to have collective training at that time.
And James, he flittered in and out of Kerry history of football. He missed out a number of All-Irelands that they won. He wasn't there for them. Why was he coming in and out? It appears to me that they only sent for him when they were in big trouble. Kerry, I mean.
I'm glad to hear you say that. That is certainly true. I don't know the reason for this. We have to delve back into the history of Kerry and its GAA structure.
Well, listen to me.
Rivalries between Tralee and Killarney. There are a lot of factors that come into that. But what you say is perfectly true. He was a fix-it man, if you like, an extremist.
If he was alive today, Lord have mercy on him, and he'd look at Mick Dwyer training Laois and Paddy Shea training Westmeath, would he be tempted to go up the country and train another team outside of Munster?
Well, without any respect to those two gentlemen, I would say no. I don't think he wouldn't have been able to do that from professional family commitments and from his own health point of view. No, that opportunity did not arise in those days. This is a phenomenon of today's competitive world.
Did he predecease your mother?
He did, by just a mere short 2 years.
He died on the 28th of October 1966. What are your memories? As a matter of fact, talk about funerals, and I'm not being morbid or anything. He had a special memory of your grandfather's funeral, hadn't he? About the big, long lot of people, a huge crowd attending it. Did he ever talk to you about that?
He did. He did indeed. In fact, one of the funerals I attended with him was his uncle, Patrick O'Sullivan from Brookhill, who died probably in the early war years. And he was buried in JP's grave in Churchtown, mm-hmm. Beaufort. Yeah. I remember that funeral in particular. I have no recollection now of Eamon talking particularly about his father's funeral, because that would be a moment of terrible sadness for him. The only thing I've seen about it, there is a photograph in existence showing the funeral cortege on that occasion, and that's with the family.
Tell us about your brothers, three brothers.
Yes. We're a mixed bag, as any four boys would be. I'm the eldest, and I was born with a love of the sea, which I inherited from the Griffin side of the family. And my mother told me that the Griffins came down from County Clare to Kerry one or two generations earlier, and that there had been seafarers in the family. Because of my love of my grandfather, Dr. Griffin, and of Ballyheigue, both summer and winter, I developed a great love for the sea and eventually pursued that as a career in the Merchant Navy. I worked on tankers for Esso for many, many years and eventually came ashore to work in marine technology. That was the greater part of my life. My second brother, Tony, went to university and qualified in dairy technology and went on to America to do a PhD in food technology. And he had a wonderful, illustrious career in that field, both in Ireland and latterly in England.
And played with Kerry, of course.
He played with Kerry, indeed, and at university as well. He was a good, strong, lanky fellow and was a good footballer. But, of course, he was also a very studious young man, and his studies were very demanding, and perhaps that inhibited his career in that sense, and also the fact that he went to America for quite a number of years. My third brother, Eddie, went to Cork University and took out a diploma in dairy science and was a creamery manager in Kerry for the remainder of his life, virtually, until retirement.
He's living in Killarney now, and I meet him on a regular basis. We often have a great chat. And who was your third brother then?
Yes. And Eddie is a great sort of local historian, isn't he? He has a wonderful love of Killarney and his people and, of course, the family as well. A lot of the information I have, I glean from him, in actual fact. And the final brother was Robbie. Robbie was a bit of a wild youngster in his day, not very studious, and my father had a little bit of trouble trying to control him. But he went on. He went to England and had a checkered career and married, had a family of his own. Worked in a variety of different jobs. At one time, he was teaching in a technical college, motor mechanics. He worked for the Gas Board doing installation work for their equipments. And now, today, close to retirement, he's the caretaker of a large comprehensive school and a member of the Board of Governors of the same school.
Well, last year in 2003, I had the great honour of doing a three-part programme on your father, The Life and Times of Dr. Eamon O'Sullivan, for my programme Terrace Talk on Radio Kerry, and I was flattered that the family were very happy with it.
Yes, indeed, yes. In fact, and I've explained this to you in my letter to you in response to that programme, it gave me a wider understanding of my father through the eyes of the people who spoke about him, people he had trained and worked with, both medically and athletically. And though I always knew my father was a very outstanding person, this enhanced that impression because it came from other people as well. And I thought, last year in particular, when Kerry's morale perhaps might have been low and an unexpected defeat in the semi-final, I thought the timing of the broadcasting was excellent.
How many children have you yourself, James?
I have four children, like Eamon and Marjorie. I had three boys in a row, but on the last occasion, my wife wanted a daughter, and she was fortunate, and we had a daughter, which, of course, is the joy of my life. Having been never had a sister, now I've got a daughter. And from there we've gone on, we've now got eight grandchildren at the latest count.
Finally, how would you like your father to be remembered?
Well, I think the memories have been laid very well in County Kerry, in concrete, both in Killoglan and in Killarney, and through the work you've done in particular to bring it to the people of today's age. I think that will be a lasting memory to him. Work you have in hand, perhaps plans you have for further investigations may add more to this. It's important, perhaps, that the story is told and recorded. We go through life in a very busy sense nowadays, and sometimes we don't have time to look at our origins, and it's important that we don't lose sight of that.
Well, James O'Sullivan, it was lovely talking to you on Terrace Talk. It was a great honour and a privilege to have you, and I hope you enjoyed your visit to Killarney. And certainly, I think, in my humble opinion, that your father was one of the great men of the last century. James O'Sullivan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much indeed. Oh, thank you.